You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105. Sponsored by the Gogmagog Hills Farm Shop, your local award-winning food retailer.
What sparked your passion for cooking?
I have a good appetite and I eat.
I'll often make subtle changes to the next batch of it.
As long as it has room to move around, it's classified as free range.
So my mother gave me a crash course in cookery when I was 16.
I remember sampling this amazing drink, thinking how I've never tasted coffee this good.
Which homemade desserts can be cheaper than shop-bought alternatives?
We want people to feel at home.
Good afternoon and Happy New Year. Welcome to the first Flavour of 2015 with Ruth Reyes, Alan Order and myself, Matt Bentman. Many thanks to Brian O'Reilly for the last 2 hours.
Today on Flavour, we look back at 2014. We've lots to remember about a great year of food in the city. But we're looking forward as well, with lots of Cambridge food and drink news at the end of the programme.
One of several new features on Flavour last year was Flavour Investigates. We looked at issues like food banks, restaurant noise, celiac disease and, on a more optimistic note, supper clubs. So let's start there by listening to what Gigi Perry, Ozzy Beck, Stella Pereira, Nazima Pathan and Tim Haywood had to say about them.
Really authentic food. Being in someone's home, the atmosphere is much more relaxed. The menus have so much thought put into them. It's such a brilliant way to try out new cuisines.
Usually you get to eat something unusual or, you know, you wouldn't necessarily get in a restaurant. It's home-style cooking most of the time. For example, Ivana used to work at Afternoon Teas. She did a Croatian supper club.
To me, it's more about the whole atmosphere, the whole event, the whole gathering, having people around a table, the conversations, the friendships that develop from them. That, to me, is a supper club.
Going to them is a really nice experience and you can relax and it's very sociable. It's not like going to a restaurant. You talk to everybody and it's great.
I often go to them by myself and it's brilliant because everyone's there because of a love or interest of food.
You always meet new people there because they tend to be, you know, like-minded people. People who are a bit adventurous when it comes to food and, you know, are willing to try new things.
Supper clubs kind of build a little community around them, and so very often people go to each other's supper clubs. It's just become like a little, you know, what our parents would have called the dinner party circuit. You know, they cross-fertilise quite a lot.
It's a huge effort to do a supper club. It's not just about the day that you have the supper club. For me, it starts a week before, or even more, because I start looking for bits and pieces that will work on that table, that will be part of that supper, and that will create that atmosphere that I want. So I start by looking for pieces, and then I create the environment, and I design the cards, and I design the menus.
Running them is very stressful. Unlike a restaurant, if you're doing pop-up events, it's a menu that you just do once. It's a one-off, so you are spending a lot of time and money, investing a lot of that in developing a menu that then doesn't pay back in terms of the repetition.
It's a lot of work. It's, you know, it's not an easy task, especially if it's a big group, but it's just getting things perfect. Or not perfect, but getting things right.
We're in a really interesting area at the moment where people are looking at the food industry as something they actually want to get into. There's a lot of career opportunities in it. It's expensive to kick off by buying your own restaurant, but a lot of people are starting either in pop-ups or street food.
It was a good way of putting our, testing ourselves and our recipes and trying to increase our creativity, but also sharing the food we like making with a bigger group of people, you know, beyond our circle of friends. And obviously, you know, with a dinner party, you might make nice food, but this, you know, when people are coming to a pop-up restaurant, you really have to deliver something special and something they wouldn't make at home or have tried before.
Well, when we spoke to supper club providers, most of them were not going to be doing it anymore, so the conclusion we reached was that they seemed to be dying out.
Stella, however, had planned one after we did this, and it was a success. It was sold out within an hour, and I believe she's planning another one soon.
Oh, how soon?
I think maybe sometime in February.
We also remembered last year that while many of us enjoy food almost as an entertainment, there are people in our city who can't afford to eat at all. Flavour investigated this and spoke with a professional who works with needy people in Cambridge and then with Evie Edwards from the Cambridge Food Bank.
It's just extremely important that people realise that actually the majority of people using food banks and free school meals are genuinely struggling. It's
And you've seen this for yourself through visits?
I have. I mean, I deal with many, many families, and actually the mental destruction it can do to a parent, and then the knock-on effect of the parenting and the chaos within the family of not having a basic survival need, which is food, you know, to be hungry, not only for yourself, but then for your children as well. It leads to then mental health problems anyway.
So, I mean, I know generalisation is difficult and actually not always useful, but in general, how do the parents come across to you?
I think most of the parents that I meet where there's real poverty in concerns of actually not being able to provide food, most of them are depressed. Their self-esteem is very, very low. Their confidence in their own parenting ability, which actually may be gold standard parenting, but actually if you can't afford food, you can't afford food. So actually everything in that family drops. So if you've got a parent who has no confidence in themselves, actually as a human being, and an ability to be able to feed others, and certainly for mothers, you know, the function of mothers is you feed your baby. If you can't do that, actually that's a sort of very raw emotion to carry, that you can't feed your children. So you have a parent, and it's not just mothers, single fathers and joint parents. Actually the mental health have plummeted quite low, and then of course that has a knock-on effect for the children who then aren't parented correctly, because actually often the parents are starving themselves. Behaviour can go awry, and experience in school. So you get a sort of a global family dysfunction, really, all down to not being able to eat. I think that the people who are brave go to food banks because there's a huge loss of dignity with people who use them. I think we've managed in some respects to lose the stigma of the sort of free school dinner, you've got the green ticket. But I think with food banks there is still that stigma. People are worried about bumping into people that they may know there. And they're worried about being seen, you know, at the food bank itself. And so I think there's a huge loss of dignity, and actually for a parent to get to a point where they feel they can ask. And then as a professional, you're only allowed to give so many vouchers, so then you have the issue of them asking and sometimes you having to say no.
How many vouchers are you allowed to give?
It's 2 in 6 months and a maximum of 3.
I was in a distribution centre on one occasion and a man came in clearly deeply, deeply unhappy. He looked as if he could just have come out of a senior common room. He wasn't the kind of person who is generally portrayed as being a food bank client. He came in, didn't look up, took the food, said thank you and left. He was profoundly upset at being there, as are many, many of the people who come to us. My first visit to a distribution centre was eye-opening. A woman arrived in floods of tears. Apparently she'd been to a doctor for some presumably stress-related illness. The doctor had discovered that she had no food in the house at all for her 3 children and no means of buying it. So he there and then wrote her a letter to bring to us, and we gave her 3 days' worth of food. She sat there with a cup of coffee, and you can imagine the state she was in.
I also wonder what she did after the 3 days.
Exactly.
We can all help with this. For example, by donating food through the trolleys some supermarkets have for the purpose, or by volunteering, maybe at Food Cycle in Hills Road, where meals are cooked on a Saturday lunchtime.
You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105.
And we're looking back at 2014. We started a couple of new features last year in addition to Flavour Investigates. Now, at the end of the year, Dave Fox from Chumpington Allotments began his series on growing your own food. Here's a little of what he had to say about preparing the ground for your crops.
Here we've got a bed where we've been adding mulch. So what we're looking at is a bed with cardboard laid down, covered with grass clippings and weeds and some old brassica leaves, and I'm going to be adding more organic matter to that. So what we're doing here is achieving several things all at once, hopefully. The layer of cardboard and weeds is protecting the land from the winter rain, so that's going to reduce the leaching of soluble nutrients away. It's also covering the land and thus preventing weed growth.
Mm.
So all but the strongest pernicious weeds are just going to die under there if you deprive plants of, you know, one or more of the essential requirements for life there. That's going to finish them off. And the third thing that the mulch is doing is, as it decomposes, it's adding fertility to the beds. It's also provides something to do with your weeds. Those weeds are a resource. They're biomass, they contain nutrients, and as long as there's not diseased material in there, you can use that to recycle the fertility onto your own land and make new vegetables. I mean, I think we all do buy in manure or composts of some form or other. It's very difficult to make enough compost and generate enough fertility on your own land, but certainly use what you've got. And this mulching technique really, really works for me. I'm using this more and more.
That was Dave Fox, who will be back on the programme next time.
And you can tweet us, remember, at Flavour105. And Annabelle and Jamie have just tweeted us to say supper clubs might be fizzling out, but not pop-ups. And they're planning one for January the 30th with Inda's Kitchen. You can get tickets on Eventbrite. It's from 7:15 till 9:30 p.m. And a big growth area in Cambridge last year was street food. There have been several new people providing it, and thanks to Food Park's Heidi White, it's become much more accessible too. Here's Heidi talking about setting up Food Park, then Emily Blickham from the Warming Your Cockles coffee cart, and finally Raphael from Korean barbecue provider Gogo Gogi Gooey. But first, why do Cambridge people enjoy street food?
I think particularly where Food Park is concerned, what's really popular about it is it's a great range and it's really fresh, cooked in front of your eyes by people who are genuinely passionate about what they're doing.
Were you having lunch here today?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I have some lunch here today.
How was it?
Great, man. Yeah, for the last few weeks I've been having it here, man, for it's so nice and it's spicy food, so you know, I'm a home food, so I have to keep coming back for it, you know?
Why do you think street food is so popular?
I think people are really enjoying an alternative to simply going to a pub and sitting down and having a drink, which of course is great, it's fantastic, but I think one of the nice things about it is that it's every street food event that I've been to has felt like an event. So, you know, you have so much range in terms of the food that's on offer. A lot of places have drinks as well, so you can have a drink, you can have something to eat.
There's always something new and interesting to eat, so lunch has never been quite so exciting, I don't think. So I'm really glad that I think Cambridge is at the very forefront of the national street food trend, so long may it continue, because I'm still very hungry.
But it's just basic things. Street food is for where life starts from, and people will always like something that they create by the hand naturally and pure. That's what makes street food comes one of the most valuable food you can ever taste. If you cook street food and you cook it into a house, street food would always be better than what you look about in the restaurant. So whatever you do, you can't beat it. Street food is the best.
So it is a collective of local street food traders who basically have been bringing their really good quality street food to the streets of Cambridge for quite a while, but they've never been given the opportunity to trade regularly all together in one place. Inspired by the likes of Curb and the Street Feast in London and lots of other cities where this is happening, I decided that Cambridge needed something similar and established Food Park as a market and a collective to trade lunchtimes in the city for whoever wants to come along to come and get street food on a regular basis.
I've got Warming Your Cockles Coffee Co. is what I call it, and it's a little Piaggio Ape 50cc of power, like amazing vehicle. It's been a good start actually for starting a new business. It's actually really good and Twitter's been amazing. I guess I was a little bit surprised by that. So it's been amazing to find this kind of local support and community around coffee and food and things. And I'm just really discovering how foodie Cambridge is. And it's great, it's amazing. My love of coffee like grew from being down under. So I've been working in the film and TV industry for a while, but I also do my own writing and developing my own things. And I was looking for a way to carry on doing that a bit more consistently, because when you're working on a film job, you know, it's full on, it's like 16 hour days for like 3 months straight, and it's crazy. So I wasn't really finding a time to be creative in my own way. And then I was back in Cambridge over the winter and taking my mum's dog for walks along the river and sort of getting to that point, which is where I pitch up at Riverside, kind of always getting to that point and thinking, man, I'd love a coffee right now or hot chocolate and there's nothing around. And that's when I thought, oh, it'd be great to have a coffee cart here or something, and told my friend about it, and we started sort of making these pie-in-the-sky kind of plans for what I'd do. So I had a bit of time off in, like, January, and I thought, well, I'll just see if I can make it work. So I just investigated. I looked into different kind of startup loans and different organisations that might be able to help with it, and I talked to the bank, and I knew the bank wasn't going to give me money, but I thought I'd ask them anyway, and they put me onto this thing called NWES, which is, like a local organisation that sort of helps with small businesses and starting them up. Kind of just went through that process and it worked. So I did that. I did one more little film job, and by the end of that, my loan was approved and I was ready to buy a little van. So it's kind of, it's that combination of finding that love of coffee, and I love coffee, flat white's my favourite, and having learned kind of, because my sister had a machine down in New Zealand, so I was making my own coffee and trying to get it right, like how they do it in the cafes and and doing that. So yeah, it's kind of all worked out from those. It's very satisfying to have someone actually compliment your coffee after you've made it. Oh, especially when it's an espresso.
Yeah.
Like when someone has a double espresso and then they just drink it there and they're just like, oh, that's a lovely coffee.
How do you pronounce the name?
The name is pronounced Gogo Gogi Gooey.
Okay,
so Gogi Gooey. Yeah, so Gogi Gooey in Korean means barbecued meat. It literally means meat roasting.
Okay.
But it refers to all the meats that they barbecue on their traditional kind of barbecue sets, which you get everywhere in Korea. So there's a huge barbecue culture throughout the year in Korea, mostly indoors on this kind of gas griddle that you get in the middle of the table.
Yeah.
So Gogi Gooey refers to all of those. The Gogo is English for go and go again. And I whacked it in front of the Gogi Gooey just that people would have an indication as to how they might pronounce the rest of it.
Yeah. How'd you get into Korean cooking?
So I studied Japanese at university. Whilst I was there, I made lots of very good Korean friends who introduced me to Korean cuisine. I knew of Korean food beforehand, but just as a result of living in Japan where Korean ingredients are far, far more readily available, I started kind of experimenting with them. I went to Korea for a month. Spent a month just basically relaxing in Seoul, which is very, very fortunate and very lucky, and I fell in love with the food. I thought it was absolutely incredible, so that when I came back to the UK, I continued cooking it. And as I said, I have a very good Korean friend in London who does a lot of street food cooking as well. I worked with him to kind of develop recipes based on traditional Korean methods, but in a way that's more familiar to kind of like a Western palate. Very much Korean-inspired recipes, but with a kind of Western twist to them.
The Warming Your Cockles coffee cart is taking a well-deserved break for now, and we'll be back in February, as well as Go Go Goji Gooey. Food Park will be starting up again soon around the city, and we'll bring you more details at the end of the programme.
You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105, sponsored by the Gog Magog Hills Farm Shop, your local award-winning food retailer.
And most of us enjoy street food, supper clubs and restaurants, but life is not so simple if you're a sufferer from celiac disease, as Ruth found out when she spoke with Grace Wright as part of Flavour Investigates.
What does it really mean to be a celiac? So if you're a celiac, it is a bit different to just being gluten intolerant. So if you're just intolerant, you might still have like very severe symptoms if you eat gluten. But if you're a celiac, you might not necessarily have symptoms. Some people don't have any symptoms, and they can be all types of symptoms. It doesn't have to be just stomach related. But basically, if you're a celiac and you continue to eat gluten, you're doing yourself long-term health damage. So your ability to line your small intestine attack themselves, because it's an autoimmune disease, so your villi attack themselves and they end up getting flatter, which then means they can't absorb nutrients from anything. So lots of celiacs when they're diagnosed will have vitamin deficiencies or anemia, and then long term obviously that risks various health complications like osteoporosis because you haven't absorbed the calcium, your risk of other autoimmune diseases, which the risk returns to pretty much normal I think once you're
diagnosed and follow the diet strictly. But if you continue to eat gluten, you're increasing your risk of all those complications, which if you're just intolerant, you're not increasing. You're going to make yourself feel ill if you eat it, but you're not at risk long term in terms of your health.
I wanted to know more about what it was like at the beginning.
So when I was first diagnosed, I thought it was a disaster. So I didn't know anything about it at all.
Right.
You're told you've got a chronic condition, and then the word disease is in there, which I didn't like. it sounds horrible.
Yeah.
You have to give up lots of your favourite foods forever, suddenly. So it's not like something like Lent, where you're going to get it back. You have to give it all up, and that's it, gone forever. You can't have it again. So then it makes going to the supermarket actually quite traumatic, because you just go in and you think, can't eat that, can't eat that, can't eat that. And you're wandering the aisles and you just think, I can't eat any of this anymore. It's a massive lifestyle overhaul. And you're obviously still feeling quite ill at this point because you're just starting out and having to cope with the adjustment.
How is it being out and about with celiac disease? And how can we make it easier for those afflicted?
Eating out and about can be tricky. I normally carry a restaurant card from Celiac UK, which just explains about the importance of being gluten-free. You get to know a few trusted places that you like. I would research in advance and look at advice from other celiacs on blogs. Or some restaurants have a separate gluten-free menu, which I would tend to favour because it makes it less confusing for me to have to choose. It makes you quite anxious if there's nothing marked, because then you have to ask the waiter, who then has to go through it with you separately. And it's much easier if it just says GF next to it, or can be made GF, please ask.
It's a difficult dietary transition, but one that is increasingly more accommodated for in cafes, restaurants, local shops, even the big supermarket chains. So let's see if Grace's comments make a change to the way that providers treat their gluten-free products this year.
And let's hope they do. A rather unusual pop-up cafe popped up on Bridge Street in May. Performance artists Hunt and Darton are an Edinburgh fringe act touring the country, combining art and food in a cafe, stopping a month at a time in each location with a feast of theme days focusing on a different topic.
So, for example, we have Austerity Day, where we encourage people to spend less money and think about the value of what they're purchasing and make sure, you know, perhaps they could share that day, or do they really need to eat? Maybe they could just have tea. There's Austerity Day, and we replace all the ornaments with potatoes just to give a clear aesthetic. We have Health and Safety Day as well.
Mm-hmm.
So we obviously operate health and safety and food hygiene all the time.
Of course.
But we are particularly safe that day, and we have a fire drill. Do you want to tell them about Christmas Day?
Oh, yes. On the 25th of every month, wherever we are, Hunt and Darton Cafe, it's always Christmas Day. And at Christmas Day, we ask the customers in the cafe to
become
part of the nativity. Yeah. They each free mulled wine and mince pies, and they become a character from the nativity.
So you might get to be the baby Jesus if you're lucky. It depends on how we cast you on that day.
Yeah.
Community Day, we do a rolling raffle, and you can also buy a trifle for the entire cafe. It's usually £10, but sometimes we open a kind of bidding war.
In Brighton, we're for £7.
We're for £7.
£7.
It was actually £3.50 from two different customers who didn't know each other, but then the entire cafe got to enjoy trifle.
Yes.
It's a nice day. I like Community Day.
Now, they do have some unusual things on their menu.
So our signature dish is the roast dinner sandwich, which is a triple-layered sandwich with the entire contents of a roast dinner, bar the potatoes and Yorkshire's, because that's a bit too much.
Do you get the gravy?
Gravy layer, and the middle bread is soaked in gravy.
Nice.
And you can have it in chicken, beef or nut. We do a roughage plate for those who want a bit more of a healthy option. That's our salad of the day.
It's also quite a good gluten-free alternative.
So you do that with rye bread as well.
Yeah. Can you do the roast dinner sandwich with Yorkshire pudding, so you can stuff the Yorkshire pudding with some of the roast dinner? I love doing that.
No?
Do we have to do what you say?
Yes.
Okay.
We also do finger sandwiches in smoked salmon, cucumber and cream cheese and sugar. And we recommend the trio plate, which encompasses all of those flavours.
And they do go all out for ambiance.
I love your decor as well. It's very original. It's very cheap.
Yeah, it's a lowbrow aesthetic. So we use cardboard signage, which declares things like hospitality within an inch of its life. Expectation is a big word. It's meant to be wobbly. Yes, that's it, is one of my favourites.
Yeah, and I love all the assorted tables, actually. It reminds me a lot of school. Some of the hospitals I've attended, some of the doctors I've seen.
It's a strange hospital that you've been to.
Well, this place reminds me of where I live, actually, with all the cardboard up on the walls.
Well, we get everything from charity shops and places like Emmaus.
So do I.
Yeah. There we go, then, that's why.
That's why I feel at home.
Join in.
Well, thank you very much, Hunt and Darton, for this interview.
No problem.
Thank you.
We'll see you again in the cafe soon.
I hope so, too.
Good.
And you're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105.
Sporting either pineapple stalks or bunches of broccoli for headdresses, you can currently find Hunt & Darton running their cafe over in Colchester, and they will be for the rest of January, as it's another location that forms part of their two-year performance art installation tour. They were really fun people to interview as well. Their deadpan comes thick and fast. And you can find out more about them by visiting their website, huntanddartoncafe.com.
And they came as part of Eat Cambridge, didn't they? The Eat Cambridge Food Festival. And I know you enjoyed going in there, Ruth, but is it a bit uncomfortable in there if you're the, you know, the quiet and retiring type?
I think if you're the quiet and retiring type, maybe don't go. Right. But it's fun, you know. They're not going to make you uncomfortable. I think it was just great fun. And the sandwich, that roast dinner sandwich was pretty, it's worth it.
Right.
Okay. Worth the uncomfortableness.
They're That's professionals what... as well. They know who to pick on.
Exactly. They know who's going to be open to it. It was fun. Yeah. In October, Matt visited the Indigo Coffee House. It's right in the centre of town, a few steps from the Market Square, down St. Edward's Passage, and as well as serving their coffee in gigantic mugs...
And that is a huge mug of coffee. That's the biggest mug I've ever seen.
It is quite big, isn't it? I'm going to be shaking for the next few hours. It was absolutely delicious, though. Yeah. I like that they serve it in, like, home-style mugs as well. Nothing's
nice.
The same, so you can choose which mug you like.
It's totally anti-corporate, which is
nice. Definitely.
Now, I like this place because of its manager, Jack, and the smiles from all the locals, some of whom were new to Cambridge and others who've been going there for years.
Here, I mean, I think I can speak for everyone who works here. We all work here because we love it.
This is the Indigo Coffee House.
There's nowhere else like it. That's it.
Fill up a chair, have a coffee.
Talking about a revolution sounds.
Now, Jack is understandably proud of his product.
The breakfast tastes so well, yeah?
They do, yeah.
And that's you get a few options, and you can have that with beans or salad, so it can be quite substantial.
Bit of a pick and mix. You get to choose three of your favourite ingredients, some bacon, some cheese, eggs, mushrooms, whatever.
It's good for students as well, because it's a breakfast-style item that's served all day.
That's true. They do love the all-day breakfast.
Yeah.
Pull up a chair, have a coffee.
If you make it, can you... Because it'd probably be better if I come back for the coffee.
Yeah, definitely.
Because I don't know where I'm going.
It's a very nice, restful place. Friendly staff and lovely food.
Yeah, it's always a great welcome here. It's the kind of place that one person can just come in and sit down and have a cup of.
I should just mention again that the Indigo Coffee House is quite tiny. Looks rather like a Quentin Blake illustration from a Roald Dahl book.
It's a bit deceptive from the outside. It looks tiny.
So it's an old terraced house that's been converted into a cafe.
But there's plenty of room to sit around, enjoy. And it's a nice, friendly, homely feel to it.
And it's really colourful. It's a bit mismatched. There's currencies all over the wall, like banknotes stuck on it. It's green and purple and all the furniture's kind of...
The chairs are very small.
The chairs are quite small, but they're very comfy.
And the tables are small too.
They're small, but they don't need to be very big because they're for coffee and small plates of stuff.
Nothing really goes together, but it works and it's really nice and cool and friendly.
And here's a tip, go for the smoked salmon.
Without wishing to blow our own trumpet here, I think we represent pretty good value for money. If you can find somewhere else in Cambridge that does a smoked salmon salad for £5.
I think that's pretty good. And we don't stint on the smoked salmon.
Well,
I don't.
Oh, God.
We are kind of tucked away. You know where the Arts Theatre is? We're right next to that. Or if you come down King's Parade and go to the camera shop, little alleyway just in between the camera shop and the shop at King's. If you go down there, you'll see us next to the haunted bookshop. It's a little sign outside where we write a message in chalk. Sometimes it's funny, sometimes it's not so funny, but we try. And that's us.
Yeah, that's us. We're the Indigo Cafe. Come and say hello.
My baby just chaos for
keep on coming in, like you see the pound notes and all the different currencies from all over the world stuck on the walls, and it makes you feel like there's been stories being told. Yeah.
And that was Jack from the Indigo Coffee House, and Matt, who's rapidly becoming Flavour's special cafe correspondent, had a good time in the recently opened Relevant Records cafe too.
Yeah, when they announced their opening via Twitter a few months ago, it caused, well, like a torrent of local attention, people saying, yes, finally!
I'm a local resident just over in Belgrave Road, and it's great to have something as vibrant and new as this. Good food, good beers, good coffee, and vinyl. It's a fantastic place, and it's really well attended tonight, so it's just great to see.
It was clear that here was something that people cared passionately about, especially having lost Cambridge independence over the years, such as Andy's Records on Fitzroy Street, Parrot Records in King Street, and Jay's on Burley Street.
It's great because sometimes you do just want to spend like a whole day in a record shop, and then obviously you've got to eat at some point during that day. So it's just so convenient.
So it is a really good idea.
Yeah, definitely.
I think so, yeah. Absolutely, yeah.
Cakes, coffee and tea, homemade pizzas, scotch eggs, sausage rolls and records, and with an alcohol licence. So it's a place that you can spend your day, and it's run by music-loving vinyl-spinning Andy Powell.
I mean, I've always had a love of music ever since I was at school, really. So listening to John Peel, taping him, taking it to school the following day and listening to it rather than listening to what the teachers have got to say.
And his wife, Angie. Angie, I understand that you'll be getting in cakes made locally, but you'll also be doing plenty of baking and so on here yourself.
We're going to be serving cakes and pastries that are all from local suppliers. So Joe from Afternoon Teas on King Street in Cambridge is going to be baking us carrot cakes, lemon drizzle cakes and chocolate cakes, etc. We're also going to be using the Gourmet Brownie Company, and we're going to be getting several different flavours of chocolate brownie from her. Norfolk Street Bakery for our bread and pastries, and of course not forgetting her Portuguese tarts. And then the things that I'm going to be doing is we're always going to have a lovely fresh homemade soup. We're going to do little stone-baked pizzas to either eat in or take away. Old school with a Breville toaster. Yeah, so hopefully a great selection for everybody to go with a great cup of coffee and a glass of wine if they'd like it.
It's a cafe with Sunday newspapers for a leisurely read, and it's a record shop in one, incorporating a live gig venue and a 70s-inspired lounge.
Yeah, it's kind of got a nice warm feel to it. There's lots of wood, lots of browns and yellows and oranges. Just generally groovy patterns, baby.
You can find Relevant Records Cafe at 260 Mill Road.
We want people, when they walk in, to immediately see that it's not two separate businesses. It's one business selling food and drink and vinyl. But when people come in, we want them to be able to see that it's clearly music related. So the gig posters, the display unit in the front, plus we'll be playing music up here as well. Difference downstairs, yeah, but we definitely want to gel the two.
Yep, just next to Cutlax and down from the Co-op.
Feel free to pop in, come in even on the evening time, yeah. Just for a drink, say hello.
And Relevant Records have tweeted to say they're now serving brunch from 11 a.m. till 1 p.m. every day. So how about things like Eggs Benedict and Prosecco?
Oh, yum. I'm getting hungry. Let's move on now from enjoyable coffee houses to enjoyable restaurants. But are restaurants always enjoyable? Sometimes there's an issue with noise, as Alan found out when Flavour investigated. We spoke with Richard from Cam's Cuisine at the Cambridge Chop House, and then to Tim Hayward.
Richard, the fashion in restaurants, and it's a very appealing fashion, is for sort of clean surfaces, hard surfaces, yes. And they look great, but it can be very noisy. Is there anything that can be done about it?
Yes, we actually have cassettes that we have suspended off the ceiling, and on the walls we also have what look like pretty bad pieces of art. They do soften the noise.
And because of just of what they're made of?
Yes, it's sort of a material we have on the walls. It's like a beige. The ones from the ceiling, I think they're more like a foam underneath a bit of material.
Right, so they just absorb some of the sound.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, great. Okay.
But they seem to work. Well, they do work.
Yeah.
The complaints, we don't have complaints anymore about the sound.
This question of hard surfaces, what do you do if that's how you want your restaurant to look? Minimalist, with no pictures on the wall. Tim Hayward.
Yeah, there's some good technology for sanding restaurants. I was really surprised to chat to a chap who was an expert on it, who'd just gone to a London restaurant where they really didn't want to change their beautiful marble on the walls and their hard surfaces and their glass, but it was impossible to talk. And he installed carpet on the underside of all the tables. And if you think about it, of course, you can put the same surface area of sound-absorbing material just in a place you can't see it. Mm. So it didn't damage the marble floors, didn't damage the marble walls, just put a thick layer of shag pile under each table. And it helps them.
But, as Tim Hayward explained, some restaurants are too quiet.
There's one particular dining room that I went to check out, which is a private dining room on the very, very top of the Gherkin in London. And I thought it was one of the most exciting places I'd actually sort of sat and to chat about. And I was talking to the manageress of the place, and she said, well, we have a real problem with this place, because, of course, everybody here is a city boy, and they're all discussing top-secret stuff. And she said, if you go and stand over there. I went over and stood by the glass on the opposite side where she pointed. And she went and sat on a table on the opposite side of the room and very, very quietly whispered, you can hear me, can't you? Mm. And of course I could. Every single word was coming over the top of this thing. And right, I mean, you literally could have eavesdropped a serious banker's conversation. And it was, you know, so actually they were putting in soundproofing at that point, which made that work better.
That was Tim Hayward from Fitzbillies, and who also writes for the Financial Times.
And don't forget, you can listen again to the full versions of all the interviews we're featuring today by going to the Flavour page on Cambridge 105's website and looking back at our previous broadcasts.
Now, another new feature that started last year was journalist Andrew Webb's historical bookshelf. Here's Andrew talking about Molly Castle's 1936 book, Travels with an Appetite.
There's another chapter here that I think is probably one of the most difficult in the book, where she spends time in the Deep South, and the chapter title is The Ku Klux Klan, and she spends time with these kind of like white boys down there and goes on this picnic, and they're all getting restless, and needless to say, the unthinkable happens. But it's the sort of detail that she paints in this scene in Tennessee, and she talks about, you know, this is prohibition, they're all drinking kind of moonshine and wood alcohol and swigging it down with ginger beer. And she says, round the big fire there were a crowd of Negroes, and they were roasting an animal whole over the fire and baking potatoes in the embers, and as they worked they sang, and one of them played the banjo for accompaniment. Presently, the white people started singing too, and they joined in with the Negro songs and spoilt the harmony. They were pretty excited, the white men, and it wasn't only the wood alcohol. There was something else going on, and I wanted to know what. As I say, the unthinkable happens, and she gets taken home, and she meets the guy she was kind of flirting with and trying to get his fraternity pin, and he's sort of ashen-faced the next day. And it's a really sort of strong little tale, actually. You're sort of left with this sort of bombshell of kind of what happened. And then, opposite that, recipe. And she gives a recipe for kind of barbecued meats. And it's that kind of juxtaposition that I find quite shocking in the book, actually. And
Well, that rather disquieting excerpt came from Andrew Webb's historical bookshelf. Andrew will be back on the programme in 2 weeks' time. And his most recent book, Men's Pie Manual, is available in the shops. And actually, I gave it to somebody for Christmas and they were really pleased with it. And I'm not surprised, it's a good book.
You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105, sponsored by the Gogmagog Hills Farm Shop, your local award-winning food retailer.
We've had a few interesting book features on Flavour this year, not least when Sarah Lavelle came into the studio. Sarah was director of illustrated books for Ebury Press at the time. In this roundup, we hear Sarah discussing some of Ebury's titles, then Gigi Perry on a student cookbook she liked, and finally, Andrew Webb talking about his new book, Men's Pie Manual.
Cookbooks, are they thriving, or have they been hit hard by the fact that you can download recipes from the internet?
It's one of the few areas of illustrated publishing that's doing really well, where you can still sell in very big numbers and you can still charge quite a lot of money for those books. We're talking, you know, 20 quid upwards. I can't really think of another area that sells in such large quantities and at that kind of high price point. The challenge is finding new exciting people and making, you know, more and more beautiful books.
So how do you find new and exciting people?
There's lots of research. Some of it's quite hellish. You have to go and eat at lovely restaurants. And, you know, it's just being involved. Twitter is a very big part of it, actually. I spend a lot of time online researching as well. And some of it, as I say, comes that traditional route, the very kind of old school publishing route of an agent sending in a proposal that they've helped an author work up. And some of it's people just contacting me direct. And indeed, that's happened on a few occasions. I've been contacted direct through Twitter by someone. I'm thinking of Claire Thompson, who is 5 o'clock apron on Twitter, if anyone wants to check her out. She's writing a book about cooking for the family, cooking for children. She's a professional chef in Bristol, and she came to my attention through Twitter. We met up, we talked about her ideas. I suggested she go off and contact The Guardian. She did, and ended up with writing a weekly column for them. So she's kind of got that profile, she's got started, she's a brilliant writer. And that kind of comes back to the essential thing, is you really have to be a good writer.
The market seems to be quite dominated by celebrity chefs. Is there much space for anybody else?
There is. And I think it's getting better than it has been the past couple of years. Ones that have bucked that trend are things like Hummingbird Bakery, which is quite interesting, and Otto Lengi, and The Flavour Thesaurus is a really interesting book too. It's done phenomenally well, and I put that down to that being bought as a gift. Like Otto Lengi, it's all in the beautiful package and design.
Gigi, you've been reviewing student cookbooks for us.
I have.
Right. What sort of things were you looking for?
The thing I think with student cooking is you're low on time, often low on budget, and it's the end of a tiring day. So what you want when you're looking for something to cook, you want something that looks fun and exciting and it's appealing. And then within that, really, it depends on what skills you've got as a cook, and then you can sort of go from there.
Okay, well, let's imagine the student who is going to go to university, yes, for the first time this year, and who knows nothing about cooking. Is there a book that can help them? Has a book been written for them?
There has. I think one of the best books I've come across is The Hungry Student Cookbook by Charlotte Pike, who was a student at St Andrews and had to survive on £10 a week. Her recipe book, she has three of them, but the main cooking book one is fantastic. And I think if you're wanting a cookbook that you can last you from freshers to graduation, it really is hers. It's brilliant food on a budget, and it has showstoppers as well as everyday meals. So you've got the showstopper, she does a sort of tequila chocolate sauce with ice cream and a vodka pasta, which is all exciting, but as well as things like spaghetti bolognese, tomato and garlic spaghetti, stir fries, salads. It's very easy to follow, and you really could be, if you're looking for inspiration as an experienced cook, it's brilliant. But also, if you've never cooked before, it's a really good one.
And with the exception of the tequila, it sounds like it's cheap ingredients.
It is, and healthy. And she gives you advice on where to buy things from, how to store it, what to do with leftovers. And it's just a very nice book to flick through as well.
Right.
So it's a good one.
Okay, tell us what it's called again.
That is The Hungry Student Cookbook by Charlotte Pike, and it's £6.99.
Everybody loves a pie. I've not met anybody who doesn't like pies. And even if you're vegetarian, there's vegetarian pies in here. If you're wheat intolerant, I've got potato top pies in here. And pies blanket this nation, almost like a sheet of pastry, from Cornish pasties to pie and mash in London to pies, Scotch pies in the north. You know, everybody in Britain loves pie. If you're working with pastry, you cannot be that flamboyant. You've got to follow a few of the basic tips and guidelines, because otherwise you won't get a result. There's room to ad lib in things like, you know, fillings or size or those sorts of things. But when you're dealing with the basic kind of elements of pastry and the kind of proportions and reactions of the ingredients that make up that, you've got to kind of pay attention to the advice there.
And there are some interesting pies in there, aren't there? Some that I'd not heard of before. Bedfordshire clanger, Dartmouth pie.
Yes, the Bedfordshire clanger. Well, that's an interesting one. I mean, that's one of those ones where it's basically meat at one end and fruit at the other. It's almost like your main course and your pudding in one complete pie. So you could have, say, pork or beef and onion at one end, and then there's a barrier in the middle, and then you have your dessert end at the other with apples and that sort of stuff.
Right.
So you can almost serve it with like gravy at one end and custard at the other. Yeah, that's an old traditional recipe dating back, must be a couple of hundred years.
Can you still buy them?
No, not really. I mean, I think there's a bakery in Bedford itself that had a go at it, and that recipe actually comes from a friend of mine called Andy Bates, who is a TV chef, and he sort of remade it, and his features pears. But again, it's part of that whole kind of Melton Mowbray pork pie, Cornish pasty. You know, each region historically would have its own pie and would be made up of the things from that region and designed by the people in that region for specific purposes, either working down the mines or... A Melton Mowbray pork pie was designed for sort of snack post-hunting, and so the pastry had to be quite tough so it wouldn't get bashed about. There's a whole history there that I think that we've sometimes in our... globalisation of the world have sort of forgotten about.
So this is Diana Henry's A Change of Appetite. Yeah, I think this book is really interesting because it's got a lot of grains in it. Mm-hmm. I find that it's coming into fashion a lot as well. People are just being aware of like quinoa and bulgur wheat, you know, and it's just, this has a lot of that.
Mm. And Cavolo Nero is quite popular as well, isn't it?
Yes, it's great to see.
An up-and-coming vegetable.
Yes, definitely. So everything is very healthy as well. And this one I would recommend more as everyday use as well, but very useful if you're doing it for entertainment. So if you're having people over, you know, friends around, I think this is really appropriate.
And there are some book bargains to be had at Heffer's at the moment. I was in there on Thursday and they had Ottolenghi's Plenty More, his new book, Jack Munro's A Year in 120 Recipes, and Diana Henry's excellent Salt, Sugar and Smoke, all at half price, which I thought was incredible.
Mm. Really good.
Now, onto some new cooking talent in Cambridge. The Cambridge Bake Off is a great way of encouraging an interest in baking, and last year we saw three-tiered cakes with an Easter theme in the final. Here's judge and 2013 winner Fiona McDuff at the Bake Off last March.
It's one thing to make a cake, it's another thing to make a three-tier extravaganza where each tier is flavoured something different and decorated differently. Yeah. It not only looks amazing, it looks really delicious as well. I figured, only three contestants, that means just three cakes. But of course, they've all done three-tier cakes. So essentially, it's like eating nine people's cakes all over again. You know, we're in good training now, so I think we can probably manage.
Lovely to see so many supporters here today. I'm Tina, one of the partners of the Cookery School, and this has been absolutely awesome to be part of this whole thing. I know my fellow judges agree with me, but we have reached a time when the bakers have been told to stop. So, Sarah, Laura and Rachel, amazing work. It's been absolutely fascinating to follow you through the rounds, and we obviously have a really difficult task, I think. We don't know how we're going to do this, but we will reach a conclusion.
Judge Tina Rush announces the winner.
So we did sort of think, how do we do this? When we started tasting them, I would like to say, and we all discussed this, that it wasn't difficult because there was one such clear winner today that we didn't struggle once we tasted. Just to keep you at attention for a little longer, we have total scores out of 10 for taste and texture. We put those together today and look. So total scores up to 10. So obviously the total that you can get is 20. And the winning cake has scored 21 points. because it was absolutely perfect, and I have never quite seen the judges, who are all professionals and really know what they're doing, quite so ecstatic, if I'm honest. That winner is Rachel.
I spoke with the remaining judges about the winning cake and what made it so special.
It's been fun. Tasting the cakes is just amazing.
Absolutely. And I think, I mean, like Tina said, Rachel's really, it was amazing. I mean, it was really standout. So it really wasn't that difficult when it came to it. But the others did do amazingly well. I just think Rachel's in a league of her own. And yeah, it was stunning. Yeah. Chocolate cake tastes like nothing you've ever tasted before.
Absolutely.
The flavours that came through, first thing for the chocolate round, you've got them hints in there, but where she used the spices and that there, but then she's got real intense flavours that marry well together.
Yeah. And the texture.
Yeah, the texture is
amazing.
It's like a chocolate sponge. When you look at it, it's like a chocolate sponge. But when
it actually has the bite of a chocolate cake, but
it melts,
then
like
it melts in your mouth. Yeah. It's so unbelievable. Never had anything like that before.
But I think she's keeping the recipe quite guarded and close to her.
Rightly so, unfortunately.
That winning cake really was spectacular. It's been nearly a year and I can still remember the taste.
And Cambridge is a great place to develop your skills in baking and cookery, and it has the best cookery school in the country, led by Tina Roche. In July, she came to the studio to explain the school's success, what it is that gives them the edge over, say, a cookery book, a TV programme or other similar classes. It was something so simple I hadn't even considered it, being hands-on. I never realised the majority of cookery classes were just demonstrations.
So many are. Mainly, you're watching a professional, and of course the outcome is quite different often. So I think, well, I'm pretty sure I know why they prefer to do that. For any chef, it's actually quite scary to give away that responsibility for the end product, if you like. And we pride ourselves in everything working, but you have to trust that your recipes work, that your teaching work, because you are putting it in the hands of people who are not used to it. And if you're looking to do it to boost your ego so you can say, et voila, you know, look at my beautiful plate, isn't it fantastic? We can't do that. We will say, well, okay, maybe that is a little bit wonkier than mine, but that's absolutely fine because you're not going to go home and do it. So you can't do it just to show your own skills. You're sharing your skills and giving them away.
My name's Tim. It's my first time at Cambridge Cookery School, and I didn't even know you could make rye bread. I just thought you... rye crisp bread, I thought you just bought it from a supermarket, so it's definitely a new experience.
Teen then went on to explain a little more about her industry background.
Can you tell us a little bit more about yourself, Teen? Now, from what I was checking out, you trained at the Leith School and you spent some time as a food researcher, yes? And I was just wondering what it is that a food researcher does. Like, you also pay attention to food trends?
Yes, in my case, that's exactly what I did. I'm sure there are all sorts of research going on into food, but yes, I was looking at changing consumer behaviour. So big diets, which can seriously alter, you know, what consumers globally are eating and therefore buying. So my job was to work with large food brands who, after the Atkins diet particularly, large food brands became much, much more aware that they needed to try and be ahead of any possible changes that were coming their way rather than only reacting when it hit them. The Atkins diet had a catastrophic effect on most companies involved in providing anything made from cereal, you know, bread, flours, because people suddenly saw it as an evil. And, you know, those were the times when you see people in cafes sort of opening their sandwich, putting the bread away in the bin and only eating the filling. So my job was very much about spotting trends early.
I was just wondering whether, does it make you irate or enrage when you see these, you know, the fads as they come down the line, and it's yet another attempt at pop psychology and fashion mixed with food, when you see things like the carb diet and you as a professional just seeing, oh my God, how do you deal with something like that?
Absolutely, I do. I frequently probably use the kind of language that definitely shouldn't go on radio when I read certain articles in the press, particularly. It is so black and white, so one-dimensional, and absolutely downright incorrect half of the time. We're just getting one side of the message, and it's about lionising certain ingredients and completely condemning others, you know, and it isn't that simple. And it does make me so frustrated that people think that they need to completely cut out certain things that I know they will miss and that are actually good for them. So if we're going back to sort of farinaceous products, good bread is a very, very good product. It certainly shouldn't be cut out of any diet. Bad bread should, but not good bread. You know, white, empty carbohydrate. I mean, I often tell my young students that the easiest way to remember what's good and bad is white and smooth is categorically pretty bad for you. Brown and rough is good. So within those, you know, they can obviously exist in the same category. And it's just so frustrating to see whole swathes of ingredients or products suddenly condemned, you know, and others hailed as be-all and end-all. And it isn't like that. We need a balanced diet. We hear that time and time again, but we really do.
And that's all. Turn off the TV for the Big Mac commercial. It's driving me straight up the wall. And I'm thinking of
I went to a Cambridge Cookery School class on Kampong Spice and Thai street food a while ago. It was really interesting because I had to cook as part of a team with that one. And that was a real change because I'm so used to just cooking by myself in the kitchen. And I was recording at a more recent class at their school whose students were company employees sent on a cookery course for a treat. And in that feature, you may have picked up on the man saying how happy he was to be able to make his own rye crisp bread. He was part of that group. And then Tina taught them all knife skills for correctly preparing fish, involving huge cuts of salmon. So they observed and then they practiced. And of course, everything they did culminated in a large three-course meal of their own making to eat at the end of the session with wine. And if you'd like to find out what classes and opportunities the Cambridge Cookery School are currently offering, you can visit their website, cambridgecookeryschool.com. Beginner's Bread is the next available class, and that takes place on the 18th of January.
You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105, sponsored by the Gogmagog Hills Farm Shop, your local award-winning food retailer.
Time for the Cambridge Food and Drink News. Tonight, Dough and Pasta's pop-up at the Six Bells in Covent Garden, off Mill Road, is fully booked. Call Cambridge 355559 to check on cancellations. Three courses from the Italian Alps for £17 is understandably very popular. And if you didn't know about it, you weren't following Flavour on Twitter.
Next week is the second and final week of the sale at the Pint Shop. £10 off every £30 you spend in their restaurant from the main menu. You do have to pre-book though, quoting the offer. Maximum table size is for 8 people.
The Black Bar Brewery is opening on Saturday from 10am till 2pm, and that's to sell bottles and mini casks. They're in Harston. It's underway now.
Yeah, and it's every Saturday as well. The Cambridge Chop House is reopening on the 17th of January after its refurbishment at 8am with barista service, something new.
Food Park will be reopening at Cambridge West off Mattingley Road on the 21st of January and will be there every Wednesday. And will be opening every Thursday at the Science Park from Thursday the 22nd of January. Also starting on the 22nd, Jalal Jalal will be popping up weekly at the Free Press Pub in Prospect Row.
A new Indian restaurant that's getting some good reviews is Navadanya on the part of Newmarket Road that's by Maid's Causeway. It does dosas, which is always a good sign.
The Cambridge Food and Wine Society has a couple of events coming up. First is next Saturday, 17th of January, an evening of Turkish food at Maraba in East Road.
And they have a few tickets left for a college dinner at Downing College on the 21st of February. Details of the events and how to join if you're not a member can be found via their Facebook page.
CD Sunday takes place in Trumpington Village Hall on the 25th of January. That's from 1:30 to 4pm. Cost is £2 for adults, free for children. It's an opportunity to swap any surplus seeds you may have or get some for a small donation. Valerie Muir of Valerie's Veggies will be speaking there about seeds are great, the politics and rip-offs are not. There will be various stalls, including a tea and cake stall and a heritage seed stall.
On Valentine's Day, there's a Food Park street food pop-up night market at Burwash Manor. Traders such as Steak and Honour, Guerrilla Kitchen and Fired Up Pizza, along newbies like Churros Bar and Buffalo Joe's will be there, as well as the Food Park bar, serving up top tipples, some special Valentine's aperitifs and nibbles. Warming your cockles will be there from their now famous gourmet hot chocolates and other sweet treats.
And that's all we have for you on Flavour today. We will be back in 2 weeks' time on the 24th of January. And if you'd like to get in touch with us while we're off the air with any news or views, you can email us, flavour@cambridge105.fm. And remember too, this programme will be repeated on Sunday morning at 7am and podcast from around about next Tuesday.
And if you think you'll forget, follow us on Twitter at flavour105 and we will remind you.
Coming up this afternoon on Cambridge 105, 1 o'clock inside the Scott Polar Research Institute with Mike Pryor, 2 till 3 when Neil Met Tony, that's Neil Whiteside talking to Northern Soul expert Tony Della, and from 3 to 4 I will be presenting Rocklit and reviewing 8 music books from 2014 and playing all the music that fits. At 4 it's Saturday Sport and at 6 it's Jason Allen. So until the next time, thanks for listening.
Goodbye.
Bye.